everybody. Hello, hello.
Oh.
Hi. Holly, what a nice warm welcome. We don't usually enjoy such a warm welcome. It's a real treat. We've been referring colloquially to this evening as the lesbian live event, which might explain why we're so oversubscribed. And I'll do my best to make all of your dreams come true. But I'm afraid maybe a couple of you might leave disappointed. We're going to speak for 45 minutes and then take a short break, about 10 minutes to go and get a drink at the bar behind you. And then once we come back lubricated and ready to challenge each other, we will have a lovely 30-minute Q&A. And also, there are ample opportunities, whether that's in the break in the middle or at the end, to buy a book at the table just in the corridor behind you and get it signed, of course, by its illustrious author. I'm just going to wait for this music to go off because I'm a diva like that. Or they could just, like, play me on. It's like at the end of the BAFTAs where they try and play you off. Okay. Tonight we're joined by two star unheard columnists. To my far right, not a political gesture. Sorry, Kathleen.
Take that back.
Is Kathleen Stock, of course, a philosopher and an essayist of great renown who taught at the University of Sussex until 2021. I'm sure you all know the story, but long story short, the university was very recently fined about £500,000 for failing to uphold freedom of speech. So do with that what you will. Kathleen is also, as well as being a writer of great renown for Unheard, an author of books including, perhaps most famously, Material Girls, Why Reality Matters for Feminism. And she is also currently writing a book about assisted dying. And she is one half of The Lesbian Project, which, among other things, produces a wonderful podcast that she hosts with the one and only Julie Bindle. Radical feminist activist, campaigner, co-founder of the law reform group Justice for Women, and author of the new book, which I've had the pleasure to read before anybody else, Lesbians, Where Are You Now? Well, it turns out, for tonight at least, they are at the Unheard Club. Please welcome Kathleen Stock and Julie Bindle. Okay, so the reason why we're here tonight is to ask quite a simple question. Is there a lost generation of lesbians? It seems more and more that when you meet... It's me versus the tech tonight. The members of the LGBTQ plus community, as they might name themselves, when given the chance, many young women in particular choose not to define as lesbian. Why is that? Let's kind of chart the history of what it means to be a lesbian and then why exactly people might opt out of it today. So, Julie, let's start with you. Why do you think women are less likely to call themselves lesbians now?
Well, at the same time, of course, there are more young women who are becoming lesbians and calling themselves lesbians. I think this is Harriet. She's got the music on. But there are those that have responded to the forced teaming in the 1990s.
<That's> going on.
And, of course...
We've got men on the decks, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Give them a moment.
Of course. We were lesbian and gay, all one word, and that was because of queer theory in universities. And then things kept being added on. Where by the time we end up with LGBTQQIA2 Spirit Plus, although I am told by my Canadian friends that the two spirit is now at the beginning of the acronym. So it's, I think, the reason why so many women are refusing to use the word lesbian or preferring to use the word gay or queer is because of this quite silent, often invisible pressure that they feel when they are in this group with various other queer identified people. And as somebody said a while back, and I don't remember who, anything south of the B is basically male kinksters, male straight kinksters.
Mm. So there's a kind of negative connotation that has come to be associated with the label of lesbian.
Well, it's more the negative connotation to refuse to use the term queer or gay, because, of course, then you take the female aspect out of it, because queer can mean any gender identity or either sex, as can gay. And so it's more that lesbians are thinking, or same-sex attracted females are thinking, that they will be labelled as something deeply unpleasant, usually transphobic or exclusionary, if they use the term lesbian. And of course, lesbian is exclusionary, isn't it? Because we're the only sexuality that excludes men.
Kathleen, I suppose this is the question this evening, is whether or not there can be a lesbian identity that escapes the connotations that Julia's mentioning there, that, or whether actually, in fact, a lesbian identity is necessarily aligned with a kind of new political movement that puts it at odds with other letters in the LGBTQ plus acronym.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I like to think of lesbian as not about identity at all, because I think once you start thinking of it as an identity, then you have to accommodate people who think they have the identity, so therefore think they are a lesbian, as it were. It's just a way of categorizing human beings according to sex plus sexual orientation, and that's it. And it says nothing about who you are, or, I mean, in a sort of further sense, or all the cultural connotations can change from society to society, and they clearly do. Sometimes it's very cool to be a lesbian, sometimes it's really not very cool to be a lesbian, but, you know, that's not built. I would prefer us, it's too late now, but I would prefer us not to build the identity into the orientation. I also think, though, in response to what Julie was saying, that it's also a reaction against the older generation. You know, they don't want to be like their mums or their mum's generation, and that's normal. And there's always an impetus on youth cultures in particular to do something new, or to try and do something new, although of course they end up repeating anyway. But so I think there was a kind of shift away from the word lesbian, because it had been so proudly proclaimed by the older generation. And now that it's been reviled for a decade, it'll probably come back. You know, so there are sort of shifts that have got nothing to do with politics, that are just to do with the way that fashions change through generations. So that's a less sinister sort of explanation, I think, for it.
Though, of course, the kind of material risk is that if everyone categorises themselves out of lesbianism, that there could actually be a kind of extinction moment.
No, because they'll still be lesbians. You see, if they stuck to my version, which is not about identity, it's just about sex plus sexual orientation, it stays constant. Basically, it's, what is it, 0.75% or something? I know I should know. But, you know, it's a small percentage of the population, and it's replicated across loads of different societies. Of course, the number of people calling themselves lesbians can be huge, but they won't be lesbians, or maybe nobody is, but they'll still be lesbians.
Okay.
But surely there's more opportunities, and it's that little bit less frightening or unattractive for same-sex attracted women to come out as lesbians and use the term lesbian if other women who are same-sex attracted are calling themselves lesbian.
Yeah, I'm not happy with a situation where nobody's mentioning it because it's a terrible word, but I'm just saying it wouldn't mean extinction, literal extinction, because I just don't think that we're that influenced by words. I think sexual orientation's deeper than that.
Well, the man that I interviewed at Nicosia University, who's written a whole book about why lesbians exist, despite the fact that we can't procreate together, said that we exist mainly because men get sexually excited by watching two women have sex, and therefore they're more likely to get somebody pregnant. So that's quite reassuring, I think. Because we've got the human race will evolve because of us.
Yeah, going. Yeah. Turn up for the.
It was gorgeous. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your service. Okay, I'm going to do something annoying and quote from your book to you. You write, while we were busy arguing that women could do pretty much everything that men could do, we recklessly, or so it seems now, threw the biological baby out with the gender bathwater. Was it a mistake to insist on the social construction of gender at the cost of recognising sexual difference?
Well, social construction of gender identity, femininity and masculinity is either a social construction or it isn't. It's like being a little bit pregnant. It has to be one or the other. So it has to be either biologically innate or it has to be something that is constructed at various points through various means. And for women, of course, gender rules, what I refer to now as gender roles or even gender identity, have been a negative force, I argue. But I do think that we went too far in that we, in looking at social construction of femininity and masculinity, we also dismissed, not all of us, some of us, and I did, dismissed the physical differences or those differences that then influence behaviour as though they didn't count. Mm. And I mean, for example, women in manual trades, right? Some of us here will have had women in manual trades in the 80s, great bunch of women coming round to put our shelves up and fix our plumbing. And that isn't a euphemism. They were very hardworking. And actually, some of them couldn't quite do the job that perhaps required a physical strength that we very rarely see in women unless they are Martina Navratilova. And tragically, she was busy that day that we needed our roof stripping. So I think that in terms of that and also childcare and women having babies together and raising babies together, where we insisted that these were two mothers and that this child would know instinctively that he or she had two mothers. When in fact children have, I understand I don't have them, but have a primary attachment and that there is a biological mother and there is another parent. And I think that we did go too far and it did not let the door open for Judith Butler. It did not. But it certainly gave some ammunition to those that were insisting that we had dismissed all of this, and then the queer lot came in much more ferociously because of it.
Kathleen, what's your take on that question?
I mean, Judith Butler was doing her thing quite early on, and Catherine MacKinnon was doing it as well from radical feminist side. So that, namely, the thing of saying that sex itself is a social construct. So never mind about masculine and femininity, but actually biology is a social contract. It's all a social contract all of a sudden. And it, they went too far. They went crazy. I don't feel like they were tapped in particularly to like radical feminism of the British kind. It was much more an American kind. And it definitely set up an unfortunate precedent for talking about the importance of biology, and also this obsession that our critics have with biological essentialism. They think that any statement at all about the difference between men and women physically is biologically essentialist, and this is supposed to be like the worst thing, crime you can possibly commit. And I don't know. It doesn't. I've actually lost track of what biological essentialism even means. But I think Butler thought that she was arguing against this idea that biology was destiny. And as in, if you have ovaries, you will end up barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. And that's, and then her amazing response to that was, okay, so there's no such thing as biology, and then we'll get out of that one. But that was a really stupid move. And the right move, as Julie says, is to acknowledge the existence of biology, acknowledge the existence of physical differences, but keep them to their proper sphere so that they don't ramify out into oppressive interpretations.
But what you've got now is Catherine MacKinnon, who's a legal scholar, arguing that rape should be redefined. It has to be committed by a person with a penis, so a man. That's how we know he's a man. And that's how we know it's rape. Otherwise, it's a serious sexual assault by penetration, etc. And what she's proposing is that you remove that necessity so that rape can be committed by women and men or people of different gender identities, she says, because she's drunk the Kool-Aid.
She must be about 90 at this point, isn't she? I mean,
she's still got the chignon, but I think even older than me. But what she's saying is that a person with a gender identity that is masculine, so a trans mask biological female, could therefore be stronger than and able to commit rape on a trans femme, so a man who presents as feminine. So she wants to remove biological sex from the category of rape in law. And she's trying to do that here in the UK I never name names just because I don't like them. Charlotte Proudman, who... it's just batshit crazy. So that's where I think we have to be really clear about biology and when it impinges on the law.
So they want to get rid of the crime of sex by deception, basically.
Oh, of course, completely. Yeah. But also that rape can be committed by women on effeminate men.
Right, okay.
Like butch women.
Let's talk a little bit about... I think in this kind of conversation you get locked into maybe speaking a lot about trans women. Mm-hmm. And perhaps an interesting... particular to this conversation here is about trans men and the way in which butch lesbianism has found itself in decline, and with the rise of non-binary identities, trans masculine identities. Can you speak a little bit about that, kind of what that's been like to witness that change and what that actually means for lesbianism going forward?
You like a butch, Kathleen.
Anyway, true. Well, the way I witnessed it, just to be serious, the way I witnessed it, I didn't witness it. I witnessed it in the classroom, basically. I witnessed it at my university. And I don't know, butch looking, tomboyish looking girls, women, coming in with their voices all... lowered and facial hair and binding. And so, yeah, I mean, I treated it in my head. Whilst I never said anything, I would never say anything to anyone who was in that position directly about it unless they initiated a conversation. But, you know, in my head, I just equated it with a sort of kind of self-loathing, really, I'm afraid. That's what I thought. Mm. And I'd seen it before. Like, I've said this in interviews before, but you know, I've taught at Sussex for a very long time. It's not just Sussex, all over. But girls would go through phases of different ways of presenting their self-harm. So there was a phase when lots of girls had cuts all over their arms and they'd take their tops off and you'd see all these scars. And I think it was particularly in a sort of, because we got lots and lots of students from London and I don't know, it just seemed like a particular kind of demographic. I don't know if it was more widespread. But that's how I thought of it at the time. And it was sad to me because, as Julie says, I like a butch. I mean, in general, it just seems sad that butch women would ever feel the need to do that.
But it's also the only strikes me as the only kind of pornified element of lesbianism. It's like the safe space of lesbianism was always the butch lesbian in some way.
It's pornified. I mean, I think...
Is it now?
Everything's pornified. Yeah. But yeah, I'm pretty sure it is pornified. But not as much, obviously.
A few years ago, it was definitely less than 10 years ago, 7 or 8, I did a feature for the Sunday Times on butch lesbians and the brilliance of butch lesbians, by which I meant visible, in your face, just rejecting all feminine trappings and the like. And it was great because... my interviewees were all very proudly butch. Some of them were quite traditional butch and femme, so their girlfriends were femme, and that's how they would present. But others were, you know, just they like dressing in a particular way, they like presenting in a particular way. All of them said to me that they've been asked at some stage, when are you going to transition? Mm. But they hadn't. And for them, this was an outrageous question. And I'd love to go back to them now. Well, in a way, I wouldn't. But to ask all of them, how do you feel about that now? Do you still think it's an offensive question? Because that seemed to me that they were clinging on to something that was so proudly lesbian, and it would have gone just like that. They would have lost that lesbian culture. They would have lost the lesbian orientation, except for they wouldn't, because they'd still be female, same-sex attracted. But what does that mean in terms of presentation and the optics for those looking around and suddenly realising the butchers have had their breasts cut off and are growing goatees?
Mm. Mm. The kind of great moments of consciousness raising in the 70s, are they a blessing? Are they a curse? What sort of legacy do those moments have that made an idea of normalising lesbianism part of everyday life?
The reason I'm laughing is because I read Julie's book a couple of days ago properly, and I realised that she has a massive go at me in the middle.
You have to hide it in the middle.
Same old.
You've read it.
It was hidden and addendum. Yeah.
Because what I said about consciousness raising, which of course I hadn't even remembered that I'd said.
Some of us remember that. Really.
Some of us never forget.
But I said, apparently, that consciousness raising was a bad thing it turned into a quite a self-indulgent aspect of radical feminism. Please don't kill me
for her unheard column. You can look it up.
We'll
just say it was, so people go to unheard.
Yeah, but I thought, I think a lot of sanctimonious nonsense is talked about consciousness raising. People talked to each other before the feminists gave them permission. Women got together and talked about their experience, and you know, it's a very, very old thing, but it got a technical name in the 70s of like sitting around doing it deliberately. And then suddenly it was presented as this amazing transformative thing. All these women who didn't even have any, knew they had any oppression before, and suddenly they were enlightened by sitting around on beanbags and talking to each other.
Don't forget about looking at the cervix as well.
Oh, yeah, well, oh, that's not, yes. Is that consciousness raising? Does that count?
For the extreme consciousness raising, yeah.
Okay. So, and also it encouraged a sort of real self and navel gazing, and I'm generally against navel gazing these days, having seen how far it's gone. Everyone banging on about their identities and all the rest of it. So
it's got a kind of narcissistic impulse.
So it was proto-narcissistic. I'm not saying it didn't help. Obviously, it really felt empowering to a lot of women, and I'm being quasi-facetious, yeah.
Okay. I understand exactly why you had the response to it that you did, because today's identity politics are exactly that, apolitical, navel-gazing, narcissistic in the extreme, completely pointless chit-chat about nonsense that isn't a collective understanding that was gained through the type of consciousness raising. And it does have a bad rap because it's called consciousness raising, but women who understood that what was happening to them, and this was part of the women's liberation movement, obviously, what was happening to them in terms of their unhappy relationships, bad sex with their husbands, rape in marriage, coercion and violence in their relationships, the assumption that they would do all of the domestic chores. There was a lot of very unhappy women thinking that was just their relationship, that was just their circumstance. And what actually happened, because you're right, of course, women did talk to each other way before the women's liberation movement, but there wasn't a name, there wasn't a way in which women could have an understanding of patriarchy, of the fact that not all men are bad, not all men impose their will, not all men feel entitled to do these terrible things to women, but that it was ingrained in every single institution, and that these women had something in common. And by talking about it, they understood it wasn't them as individuals, they weren't mad. And the father that was sexually abusing them wasn't a weird outlier who was a complete and utter oddball, that there were other men doing this or excusing other men doing it. So I think the political consciousness raising was really important.
Mm. Let's talk about asexuality, because that's another...
Thank God for that,
Another part of the prideful spectrum that has in some way I suppose, impeded the gathering of new lesbian recruits, because many have decided instead that they are, in fact, asexual. In fact, someone I know recently told me that they were either lesbian or asexual, which I thought, just on a logical level, seemed difficult, but fine. Tell me about asexuality. What is it that about it that kind of challenges a traditional
should be quick
traditional idea of sexual preference?
Well, nothing. I mean, because lesbians can be asexual. I mean, that again, if you return to like the definition of same-sex attracted females, heterosexuals can be asexual, lesbians can be asexual, gay men can be asexual. It just means you don't do something or feel something, maybe. But
I mean, I would slightly challenge that, though. Surely, like, how can you be both not sexually attracted and have
well,
a
do
sexual
not assume, Flo?
Because there are asexuals who are sexually attracted.
So I was at, on a university website, which I won't name, and it was International Asexual Day the other day, in case you missed it. And they had an interview with somebody who said that we should not, I mean, this was an asexual person that worked in, on campus, that we should not assume that asexuals don't have sex. They do. They just don't. I don't know why they have sex. She didn't explain like what is in it for them, but they do. So right. And the whole explanation of asexuality that's given by Stonewall is it's a spectrum, and there's a thing called grey sexual. I can't remember what that is.
Mm. Or demisexual, my favourite, which is they can only have sex with people you fancy.
And sapiosexual.
My preference.
Sapiosexual.
Sapiosexual I like.
Sapiosexual.
Yeah, it's good to distinguish from the furries.
Sounds familiar.
To some extent.
We've done sapiosexual.
I think we have.
Yeah.
But yeah, but you're right, I suppose. I suppose if you're properly asexual, as in like absolutely nothing going on down below, then you don't count as a lesbian.
But it's the fact that there was a proud asexual who was leading the Pride March a couple of years ago, Yasmin Benoit, who for some reason just seems to want to troll everyone by dressing in a way that she possibly thinks is hooker chic and is just utterly, ridiculously sexualized whilst demanding to be recognised as a proud asexual.
I agree with you, but can I play devil's advocate? Because feminists are always saying you should not judge a woman by the clothes she wears. It does not mean she wants to have sex with anybody or that anyone should have sex with her. And that is like being said hundreds of times, no matter how short the skirt, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. So why doesn't this apply to asexuals?
Because it's clear that she's having us on. I mean, okay. She
make of that what you
because
will.
She wants one of us to say, you're dressed in a very sexualized way. That must feel really empowering for you, Yasmin. So she can do that speech.
Oh, I see.
And she obviously has got no oppression in her life to do with her asexuality. She wrote a report with Stonewall in which she said that, do you know 40% of asexuals aren't even out at work? Well, good. I mean, don't bring your whole self to work, please. Because why on earth would you have to sit down there with HR and say, as an asexual person, I'd like, what is it again? Reasonable adjustments made. What would that be? Not wanting to take sex breaks or having something else in place of sex breaks?
It's
okay. That's well, let's talk about the opposite then. If the rumours aren't true, and in fact there isn't a kind of decline of lesbianism, perhaps we are in a moment of lesbian revival. We spoke before we came on stage, dare I say, about Chapel Roan, who proudly refers to herself as a lesbian. She says in a recent Pitchfork article, I'm never dating a man again. I'm not attracted to them. I do not like having sex with them. I don't think they understand me. I don't think they make good art, which I thought was a nice additional one. It's like a creative lesbian as well. Are we, and we reference as well, last summer, which was apparently, sorry if you missed it, hot lesbian summer.
Well,
apparently for a few of us.
According to several magazines that we consulted at the time for our podcast, last summer was hot lesbian summer.
Yeah, is there room for optimism here? Is there actually, potentially, as Kathleen suggests, a moment here that we reach where lesbianism has become so uncool, it goes the full 360 and becomes cool again?
Well, it happened last summer. Now it's over. So I think so. I mean, I think so. One thing I have to do for the podcast every week is put lesbian into Google, hit news and see like what stories have involved lesbians. And there's loads and loads and loads in the last, probably not, I mean, post us starting. So I like to think that we galvanized the entire thing. But and especially during so-called hot lesbian summer, there was all these films came out whose names have completely escaped me. But one of them was Love Lies Bleeding. Is that right? Yeah. With Kristen Stewart. There was lots of films featuring lesbians. There's a lesbian bar in London, which was in Vogue magazine, and they had lots of pictures of gorgeous women there. I don't know, Chapel Roan. So, and they're all using the word lesbian as well. It's really noticeable that they are saying the word lesbian. So I think that's encouraging, and we should be pleased about that. Although, obviously, if there's a peak, there'll be a trough. You know, it is a fashion. It will go out. But for the moment, I think it's much more acceptable to say lesbian than it used to be.
Mm. What's changed there, Julia? Like, why do people feel more comfortable saying that now?
I think there's been a response to the awful backlash against lesbianism and same-sex attracted women being under pressure to say that they're anything but, and that there's also a sense of pride in having maintained that boundary, in saying that no lesbian doesn't mean that we will have sex with a feminine presenting person with a penis. It means that we are attracted to other women. And that has filtered down, I think, into the apolitical and into for middle class women at university, the backlash by them against some of the LGBTQ societies that are routinely run by men, where they are just getting a bit sick and tired of it. And there's also more references in popular culture, which of course is a chicken and egg effect. But I interviewed lots of young lesbians for my book, and there were quite a number of them that said when they got in contact with me via social media, when I put out a request, oh, by the way, I was one of the women that tried to have you cancelled at Manchester, or fill in the name of the university 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And yeah, sorry about that. And I obviously, you know, realised I was a dickhead. And it's really great because these are young women that have gone through that and have realised that this is not great, because they themselves could be in the end of a cancellation.
Yeah. You have to realise your own interests are being threatened. And I think it does take a while for that to be obvious. And also just to add, sorry, but you know, the situation was pretty dire. Like, when we started the Lesbian Project, we put out a report which showed how little charity funding was going towards lesbians, how few mentions there ever were of the word lesbian in any Stonewall report or any other report that purported to speak for us. That obviously the social scene was completely decimated, probably still is. So yeah, it was really, really bad. And I think drawing a whole bunch of people, including us, drawing attention to that in Britain did pique a few consciences. I mean, people who spend their lives saying they're doing good in the world and they're trying to be, you know, get rid of oppression, and then it's pointed out to them that they are doing absolutely nothing for lesbians, despite the word that we're at the beginning of the LGBT, blah, blah, blah.
Not now that Two Spirit's gone there.
Oh, really?
Do you have two spirit bars in Soho next? Okay, I'm going to read again from your book, Julie, for my sins. This is a quote from the Gay Liberation Front manifesto, 1970. As we cannot carry out this revolutionary change alone, we will work to form a strategic alliance with the women's liberation movement. In order to build this alliance, the brothers in gay liberation will have to be prepared to sacrifice that degree of male chauvinism and male privilege that they still all possess. So, the obvious question is, gay men, are they allies or antagonists to lesbians?
Well, I think 3 years after that quote, the lesbians walked out of the Gay Liberation Front because they were so tired of the sexism. And there were men that would sit around knitting and dressing in, you know, I mean, they would wear skirts and they were subverting something or other, but they expected the women to make the tea and the sexism was off the scale. And in fact, Bev Jackson, who is one of the founders of the LGB Alliance, a great hero of our movement, she was one of those lesbians that was there at the first meeting at Highbury Fields, 1971. And she was one of the lesbians that walked out because she was sick of it. So we've had decades, I think, of where we've been force-teamed with gay men. There was this complete and utter mythology that we were as one with gay men over the Section 28 kerfuffle, which was quite short-lived. And gay men, some of them, took the attitude that I think was personified in a headline that was in a listings magazine called City Limits, which was before Time Out, The Road to Auschwitz, that Section 28 was the road to Auschwitz. And this was the way that lots of gay men saw this piece of legislation, which was bad. It was a bad piece of legislation. But lesbians in general took a very different tack. And we figured that we'd been through way worse before and that we would go through way worse again. And where were the gay men when lesbians were having our children taken away from us by family court, punishment raped and the like? And that we would, of course, protest Section 28. But this didn't mean that we felt an affinity with gay men that would last beyond that. But then, of course, queer was embedded within the social scene. And lots of lesbians who weren't feminists decided that gay male culture was more attractive to them than feminism. And I'm not unsympathetic to that. I think that feminism was quite unattractive for women for reasons that so we'd all recognise. Quite sectarian in ways, but it was a lot of fun. So gay men and lesbians have got nothing in common. It doesn't mean we can't be friends. And Kathleen may well disagree with me. This is all fine. It doesn't mean we can't be friends. It doesn't mean that I don't actually love some individual gay men. And we have now formed a deeper alliance with some of those gay men that are fighting gender ideology because they see what we as lesbians are suffering. And that's really great and heartwarming. But we have nothing in common, except for that we are occasionally, rarely targeted together. Section 28 was the only piece of legislation that we've ever been targeted alongside gay men with, and that's it.
Mm. Kathleen, anything to respond?
I mean, I think we've got same-sex attraction in common. Obviously, it's not the same sex, if you get what I mean, but, you know, it's not heterosexuality, and that does... I mean, that was a reasonable point to make, but it blew up to mean everything. And obviously, there are many differences, partly because of our sex and partly because of the sex of the people we're attracted to. And one of the most obvious differences is in sexual behaviours, typically, you know, and that doesn't get mentioned. But, you know, women are moving in together on the second date and men are having sex with lots and lots and lots of different men, from, you know, as a, well, so I hear. And that's partly to do with who men are and who women are. And this is where I would go beyond what Julie said and say that there's probably differences in the way that, you know, the way our sexual behaviour manifests itself that is partly to do with estrogen versus testosterone. Mm. It's not all socially learnt. And libido is affected by hormones. So that sort of thing makes a difference. But I do think, bearing in mind that I wasn't there and I'm looking in retrospect, I mean, I was alive, but I wasn't participating in any activism as Julie was, that AIDS kind of hoovered up everything, I imagine, for a decade. And it was such a terrible narrative for gay men, that, you know, I understand why they became the focus of political activism for all that time. I completely understand that. But it was because of AIDS. It wasn't just a natural state of affairs that men should always get the limelight in that way.
Hmm. Okay, final question before we go to a quick break. Would the world be a better place if more women were lesbian?
Julie.
Well, it's bad enough going to Lesbos or Hebden Bridge and not being able to walk around without recognising your ex's ex's best friend. Well, the only way I can answer it is this. The world would be a better place for some women if all of the constraints were removed from them feeling able to happily come out as lesbian if they feel attracted to other women. That would make the world for them a better place. And there would be more women coming out if all of those constraints were removed.
Hmm. Preparing for this second half and, in fact, our Q&A. Now, I know I was really nice in the first half and I seemed like a kind of soft and docile person who would never anger easily. But, in fact, that was just the first half me. The second half me is really, really nasty. So, what I want from you all tonight is a question. Now, that is a sentence with a question mark at the end of it. The more questions we have, the more answers we can get. And that's, after all, what we are here for. So what we're going to do, as well as ask for questions rather than statements, is we're going to take two at a time. That means if your question turns out to, rather than be a question, be a statement, it can get quite easily ignored. So what I would recommend would be that you ask a poignant, short question, and then we will take two at a time and we'll get through as many as we possibly can. We're going to take hands up. We've got a microphone that will come round to you. So wait for the microphone to be on your hand before you start asking, and we're going to take two at a time. Let's start straight away. Phoebe's got the microphone. Thanks, Phoebe.
Hi, both. Which is more important, being a feminist or a lesbian?
That is a perfect example. I didn't love her. Whoever that is, great. And let's take another one while we're at it.
Yeah.
Thank you both. Practical question. What can I do to support the young people I know in my life, both friends of my kids and kids of my friends, who are actually lesbian but don't know it and think that they want to be men and are profoundly unhappy and are not just taking hormones, they're taking antidepressants as well? How can I help them?
Great. Okay. Two questions there.
Well,
however you want to start.
Question one, feminism. Because feminism is a movement that strives for the liberation of all women. And if we do feminism right, that means lesbians as well. We are not a subset of women. And if we have lesbians that reject feminism and are anti-feminist, then we're going to end up even more in the mess that we are in right now with gender identity. For example. The second question, I don't know, do you want to take this one?
No. You.
Right. Well, I personally think that this complete madness is shifting in the right direction, but that doesn't mean that young people who are caught up in it now are going to be able to get out of it very easily, because it is a cult. And I think the advice that I would give would be advice that I've heard on various podcasts, because I'm obsessed with cults and I listen to lots of podcasts about cults, is to not say you are wrong, this is terrible, what you're doing is harmful, but to just offer the tools such as meeting others that might be lesbians and not feeling the necessity to label themselves as anything but, and to just leave things lying around that might pique their interest. And don't do any of that social media blackout and curfews on looking at TikTok, because it's just going to pique their interest more. But to talk about good things to do with sexuality and sexual orientation rather than what's terrible about the non-binary or trans identity.
Yeah. I think there is a book or a resource on the Sex Matters website. I think it's the Sex Matters website. It could be Transgender Trend, but it was written by I think I'm right in saying Matilda Gosling, and it was an evidence. It looks at the available evidence for how best to talk to teenagers about this. But definitely one thing that sticks in my mind is just not starting to knock heads about it, so that you get into sort of stuck position where you're saying your thing and they're resisting because you're saying your thing. And basically, you know, they say something inflammatory about non-binary or whatever it is, and you say, that's nice, what do you want for tea? You know, it's sort of not necessarily making it into this huge panicky thing. But that's just a, you know, that's a superficial answer for a range of problems. And I know that there are parents in the audience now who'll be thinking, well, that is completely irrelevant to my child. So really read up, I would say. But on the first question, lesbianism. That's it. Well, I mean, it's a stupid, good question, but
you just
also a stupid one.
Stupid.
A good stupid question, because they're not the same. They're completely, it's like apples versus tables, you know, like, but if I heard it as a desert island question, like if you were on a desert island, would you be a lesbian or a feminist? Well, I'd be a lesbian.
Well, yes. But that's because you'd be on a desert island and you wouldn't want to sit around cervix gazing or consciousness raising.
Exactly.
To do other things.
Exactly.
Okay, let's take another two.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Given the amount of legal cases that we see coming faster and more furious, do you think we're going to win?
That's great. I'm so proud of everyone with that question. This is great. Let's keep going.
Do you think that there's much hope with fighting against the LGBT plus charities around recognising what a lesbian is? Or do you think the strategy going forward is organisations like the Lesbian Project, LGBT Alliance and such like?
On the first question, I think we do need, this is personal opinion, we need to define what winning looks like, you know, as opposed to just carrying on past the point at which we've won and not even noticing. And I think, I'm not saying we've won, or what even that means, but we are, there's lots of victories happening. And today, I mean, I don't know if it's going to be a victory, but today we found out that the For Women Scotland judgment will be handed down next Wednesday. The Lesbian Project intervened in that, so did Scottish Lesbians, so did LGBT Alliance, and that's about the meaning of women in the Equality Act. So that's going to be a big thing. I think the traditional charities that purported to speak for sexual orientation are done, basically. Absolutely toast. And I hope that they, I don't think we've got plans to become a charity anytime soon, but.
The obvious reason.
Yeah. What? We'd mismanage the funds.
That was one first class flight. No. But I think, you know, we're all minded of the mermaid.
Oh, well, yeah, that.
Against the LGBT Alliance.
Yeah, but then but LGBT Alliance won, and they are a charity now, aren't they?
At the time that we set up, we had that in mind. Yeah. It wasn't the only reason.
It encourages a lot of scrutiny, obviously, and LGBT Alliance paid the price for that, but they are now thriving. And every time they do something new, I'm like, my God.
Yeah.
Your initiatives are so impressive. So I hope they take all the prizes.
I agree with Kathleen about needing to look at what winning means. For example, a great feminist victory was criminalising rape in marriage, which came into force in 1992. Women who were married to men were still being raped. Many women didn't know that rape in marriage was a crime. Many police officers didn't arrest. Many of these men weren't convicted. But it was a normative effect and it was important, but you wouldn't describe it as winning. And I think that there's definitely an erosion of the normalisation of gender ideology, which will have a knock-on effect of the institutions that have bought it hook, line and sinker. I personally think some institutions need to be completely burned to the ground, metaphorically, of course, and rebuilt. And universities would definitely be part of that list. But yeah, I think that things are going in the right direction. But at the same time, there are so many victims of this horror. So many. And this is terrible. Mm. It's obscene.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another two questions. Hands up, and Phoebe can come to you with the mic.
Thank you. I'm actually not sure whether you can answer this now after what Kathleen said, but I just wondered, with For Women Scotland ruling being next week, how you're feeling about the implications of a For Women Scotland loss for lesbians.
Mm-hmm. And then another one before we continue. Well, hands down here. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about identity, an identity to yourself, not to others. When you wake up in the morning or you look at yourself in the mirror, what is this that you see? It's a woman, lesbian, feminist, nothing. Oh, none of that, none of the above.
Right. Nothing. That's what I see. The void.
I'm a feminist. I don't look in the mirror.
As I think you can tell.
What was the first question?
What was the first question? Oh, the loss.
The loss.
Yeah, I'm actually, obviously, I'm sure everyone is extremely nervous because it's a big risk because there's no other court. It's the Supreme Court. Well, yeah, European Court, I don't know about that. I refer you to our legal counsel. But, yeah, I mean, the signs are good as far as I can tell. And the fact that if you watch the actual, what do you call it, questioning period, whatever, when the judges were actually cross-examining witnesses or the lawyers, talking to the lawyers, they mentioned lesbians quite often. And we, the Lesbian Project, luckily, thanks to Diane Stoyanov, who's here, and Matilda Gosling, we produced a number of reports about sort of differential impacts on lesbians in a number of areas. And we used that in our submission, and then the judges referred to some of it. So that was extremely pleasing for us. However, if we lose, I will just deny that happened.
Well, I don't think we'll lose. And I'm fairly optimistic, but never with courts, because decisions and verdicts with courts I've seen over the decades have been quite shocking and unexpected. But I think we'll win. In a way, we shouldn't really have to fight these things through the court. I think it's a terrible risk to take these cases to court. But I think we did the right thing in doing so with this, because obviously the country is operating under Stonewall law, Scotland, obviously, and parts of England and our institutions. So we need to clarify it. And it won't mean that a man can be a woman, and it won't mean that a man can be a lesbian, but it will mean that the judges are absolutely batshit crazy. Because listening to the KC, who was representing the Scottish ministers, that woman was desperate to go to lunch as early as she possibly could. When she was talking about the fact that Dave and Pete, two blokes that just present as blokes, but one has a gender recognition certificate that you weren't allowed under the Equality Act to ask him about, but he's a lesbian, but Dave isn't, was a beautiful moment. The judges' faces, you could have parked a Ford Cortina in the furrows in the foreheads. Absolutely bonkers, and I think they got it. And if we win, I think the lesbian argument will have won it. I don't mean that all of the interventions are brilliant for Women Scotland and everybody, sex matters, but I think the issue about lesbians will have won it.
It would have played a part, I would say. I wouldn't want to...
No, no, I don't mean we as interveners will have won it.
But even...
I mean the argument itself was so stark that...
It was helpful. It was definitely helpful, yeah. I think.
Can I just ask if there is a difference between US and UK lesbianism, not in the practices or preferences, but rather in the state of lesbianism in the US versus here, because I understand...
There's a state called lesbianism.
Sign me up.
The 37th state.
What do you hear from your US lesbian allies?
I think it's a shit show, isn't it? But
it's
I mean,
a shit show beyond shit shows.
I don't know, to be honest, and maybe the people in the audience know better, but since Trump's come in and he's revoked a whole bunch of things that Biden had brought in under Title IX, I mean, it's a war and it's being fought on extremely polarised political ground. So, you know, that doesn't help, really.
Mm.
The left has just completely capitulated, mm-hmm. almost completely capitulated on that issue and left it open for their enemies to mm-hmm. take advantage of.
But the worst is Tranada, of course.
Mm.
The worst.
Why?
Because Trudeau doubled down on supporting gender identity along with all of the other things bad for women, such as what he refers to as sex work, and saw this as empowering and liberating for women.
And it was put in their law early on.
Yes, I mean, they've had self-ID.
Before anyone had a clue, gender identity was protected. And after that, it's really hard to not make judgments in favour of gender identity when basically the law is telling you to. Same in Australia, I think.
Yeah.
Mm. Let's take another question. Yeah, there's some nice hands. Yeah, let's go here. Go for it.
What do you want politically from men?
Great. And then let's take another one and we will have some answers as well.
I have one statement, which is I think the Lesbian Project podcast is bloody brilliant. It's so amazing. And probably a question on everyone's minds is there going to be a spin-off of a cooking show? Cooking podcast.
Uh-oh.
We cannot speak of this.
Well, I think Julie should get on Celebrity MasterChef and I think we should make it happen.
Yeah. Or you could do like crisp reviews or something.
Yeah. I mean, but Julie's an untapped resource as far as that's... Well, no, you're not that untapped actually because you write a food column for The Spectator.
But I just slag things off.
Well, that's true, but that's why people like it.
But we can talk on the podcast. We talk about food we like, restaurants we like as
well. Yeah, we do. I went to a lesbian-themed restaurant this week.
Themed?
Well, it was called Topless.
Oh, God.
So it's topless. Alice... Topless. Topless. As in Alice B. Topless. Look it up. Anyway. Simon Fanshawe had a question.
Okay. Another question.
No. Simon's question.
What do we want for men?
Politically. I don't... I struggle with that question because nothing much, really. I mean, obviously the answer you're supposed to give is allyship.
No, we hate that.
But that word's
no.
gone. So, obviously, I just think it's an alliance of sensible people against all this stuff. And I really am happy when men agree with us. And quite often it's women, you know, who are the biggest true believers in gender identity, so I'm just not going to split it that way, I think.
I think there have been times when lesbians have stepped away from our key concerns as women to support gay men, which is all good. And it would be good, I think, when we need that support, which we are getting on gender identity as affects women and lesbians in particular, maybe, that we would get that from men to step out of the immediate what life is like for gay men, what those needs are, which we know fine well what those needs are, Simon, let's face it, but to look at women's lives under sexism and how that can affect lesbian liberation or lack of.
Okay, let's try and take another two before we end. Yep, there's one down at the front. Question here? Yeah? Let's go for it. And then we've got one right at the back. I'm sorry, Phoebe.
Yeah, I do quite a bit with the LGBT Alliance, and I was at the London Lesbian Collective event recently and met some fabulous young lesbians. They were just great and they were so active, but they didn't want to join the LGBT Alliance because the LGBT Alliance involves men. And I was quite interested in whether you've come across other young lesbians who are effectively lesbian separatists, because I was quite surprised, actually, but very impressed.
Great. Let's take one question right at the back.
What do you think, out of all stereotypes of being lesbian, is the most of a lie and probably offensive to you?
While we think about that one, I haven't actually come across any young women who want to be separatists, but I don't think they would, I wouldn't be their choice of feminist heroine or whatever, you know. I mean, I'm really not into that stuff. So it is interesting if that is a trend, that would be interesting. What about you?
I think we need a group, as that's why we set up the Lesbian Project, to look specifically at women, at lesbians. And that's because we were being lumped in with all and sundry. And that doesn't work, obviously.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. Obviously. Yes, I thought you meant like living separatists, as in living apart and rejecting.
I was a separatist for 6 months back in, I think I was about 19 or 20. And then I realised that I couldn't get on the bus because I would have to speak to the bus driver. And I couldn't go into a shop and I was shouting at men that were calling me love. Because it was Yorkshire, that was fine. And so I just thought, this isn't working for me. And so I dropped the separatism.
I can't think of anything worse, to be honest, than being stuck in a house of militant lesbians.
What stereotype do you most dislike? And just to add on to that, what stereotype do you think is true?
Oh, God. this is not right answer to the question, but when I came out first, one of my friends, and then I've got a mutual friend here tonight who knows who I'm talking about, said to me, she's heterosexual, in all seriousness, she said, why do you people, and I'd only just come out, so I was like, wear such horrible shoes.
good thing. Don't want to name any names, but I am wearing Stella McCartney's right
well,
now.
Well, yeah. Like, you're oh, obviously fine. Heterosexual. But in answer to the other bit of the question, I think one of the stereotypes that does kind of fit is the merging thing. Mm-hmm. Like, as in, not all, everyone, but like sort of a tendency to go overboard and like not have healthy boundaries.
Do you think gay men have the same problem?
I would not know. I would not have a clue. And I would not want to speak for them.
Julie?
No, I don't think so. Not to the same degree as lesbians. Mm. And I'm sure that they don't wear matching North Face jackets and have their hair parted on the same side.
Oh, that's lovely. With that, I'm afraid we have come to the very bitter end. Please do buy a copy of Julie's wonderful book on your way out of here. Get it signed. It's just lovely to see, firstly, so many women in this room. It's a very rare occurrence for me. And also to see such long queues for the toilet, another rare occurrence. Apparently we've run out of wine glasses, so you're not nearly lesbian enough because you haven't been buying the beer. So please buy one on the way out. And in the meantime, please do thank Julie Bindle and Kathleen Stock.